So, hello to everybody. I welcome you to this panel. My name is Katja Koblitz. I'm from the Spinnboden Lesbian Archive and Library, and I have the pleasure to be your chair for this panel. Our speakers will be Magdalena Staroczycki, from the University of Warsaw, Margaret Hauser from the Feminist Library and Archive Stichwort in Vienna, Maria Bühner here on the right side of the University of Leipzig, and Sabine Balke Estremadoria from the Digital Women Archive DDF. All speakers are asked to introduce themselves and not to speak longer than 50 minutes. I will be the timekeeper. So, and I give you all a sign when you should come to an end. I will show you a yellow card 1 minute before and then say, okay, well, just come to an end. And when I show you this card, you have to make one sentence and then to stop. So this is my duty today. So in the end, after the four speeches, there will be time for discussion and questions. So, and then I will start. I will give now the floor to Magdalena. And could you just tell us your name correctly?
Staroszczyk.
Staroszczyk. Okay. So, please welcome Magdalena Staroszczyk. No. Okay.
Hello, yes, my name is Magdalena Staroszczyk and I'm a PhD student at the University of Warsaw and also a member of the International Kruszew team. And I would like to talk to you about some thoughts on the subject of lesbian existence and lesbian identity in the Polish Pops Republic and during political transformation in Poland. My research examines the experience and self-identification of non-heteronormative women who do not always identify themselves as lesbians. In my research, I focus on auto-narrations, that is the way women speak about their lives. I'm also interested in the cultural context and what discourses have been produced in the chosen period of time, as well as representations and lesbian figures that were present in literary or film circulation. The data for my research consists mostly of in-depth interviews conducted by me and of existing oral hair stories. For a year, I have been a member of this International Kruszew team, and for this particular project in Poland to this point, 12 women has consented to be interviewed out of the total number of more than 40 interviewers. So women are about 1/4 of the respondents. Other important sources for me here include the pioneering book by Anna Laszuk. In Polish, the title is Dziewczyny wyjdźcie z szafy. It's Girls Come Out from the Closet. And it is a collection of interviews with lesbians conducted between 2006 and 2009. In this collection, we can find also about a dozen short memoirs of women who remembered. Thank you. Who remembered the times of the Polish Pops Republic. And I also analyzed early LGBTQ zines and magazines, as well as cultural texts available and the general circulation. The time frame of my research is the long 70s of the 20th century, with the turning points in the 80s of the Hyacinth campaign and the beginnings of the epidemic of AIDS in Poland, and the period of political transformation, the beginning of LGBT and feminist movements in Poland in the 1990s. As the closure of this period, I recognize the action Let Them See Us. You can see now one of the pictures from this action, organized by the campaign against homophobia in 2003. Here is what Anna Gruszczyńska, one of the organizers, says about it. The most important moment which caused that there were more and more girls was the Action Let Them See Us, an exhibition of 15 photos of lesbian and gay couples in four Polish cities, plus billboard campaign, plus educational campaign. We started to call for models in the fall of 2002. Very quickly, we found 15 gay couples, but there was a huge problem with lesbian couples. At some point, there was even the desperate idea to bring models from the Czech Republic, because they have a similar look to Polish women, and no one would catch on if some girls from befriended organization in Prague appeared as Polish lesbians. That didn't happen. Most people assumed that all the couples from the posters are real, while in fact there were only five or six real couples. So we, Agnieszka Gruszczyńska and the other girl, gave some interviews for the press as a couple. We agreed on the basic facts before, how long we are together and what are our views about having children. 10 years earlier, in the 90s, LGBTQ, or rather LG movement, and the feminist movement in Poland were only just beginning. Here is an expert from early zine Inaczej from 1991. You can see it also at the exhibition in Szwules Museum at Karol Radziszewski exhibition. And as in most Polish LG magazines from that period, the greater part of this publication is dedicated to gay men. For lesbians, there were only single headings or pages. On this page, like in a lens, we can see the voices clashing within the movement itself. I will not analyze visuality today, so I will leave the illustration without a comment. So sorry for this. So in the first column, we can find a big question. Are there any lesbians in Poland? It is a call from first lesbian group in Krakow to other lesbian girls and women to come out and join the community. In second column, a sad letter written by high school girls from the town of Zielona Góra, telling about unpleasant repercussions with which they met after being caught in the act by families, ending with a warning. The other couples should be really careful because the so-called normal people are capable of terrible things. Unnamed. In the third column, we can see an even more dramatic letter by a woman from Russia, or Soviet Union in the process of dissolution, in which she describes being locked up by force in a psychiatric hospital for being a lesbian and treated against her will with sedatives on a kind of convert therapy. Those voices show the inconsistency of discourse within the LG community and the profound uncertainty about what strategy should be adopted by the community. The emancipatory language of Krakow's activists is undermined by two traumatic personal narratives. The reader is faced with a dramatic choice. This is a symptomatic moment, and the choice is one that non-heteronormative people will have to make over the following decades. Whether to join the LG, then BTQ plus movement, when it was constituted or not, which in language of coming out narrations usually means to stay in the closet. On the first plan, the single page shows a paradox in the narration produced by authors of the magazine. The communicate here is people do come from the closet, but be careful because it is dangerous, so maybe better don't do this. On the second plan, or in subtext, we as readers may find that the motivation of not coming out is anxiety, while in fact motivations could be various or different. The topic of lesbian visibility still present in today Poland, and not only here, occurs as a major research problem, and by that I mean not only an almost complete lack of historical sources, but also the question of how we can talk now about lesbians who did not exist. What does this non-existence really mean, and shall we call those who supposedly did not exist lesbians? To illustrate this problem, let me begin with some experts from my interview I conducted with a 66-year-old lesbian. And she say, to this very day, I have a problem with my brothers. I cannot talk to them about this topic. They just cannot do it. I would like to talk, but they have this problem. They lace up their mouths when any reference is made to this topic because they were raised in that reality. No one talked about it. It was a taboo, and it still is. That I was so weak, so unable to take initiative about a concept of my own life, all this testifies to the oppression of homosexual persons who do not know how to live, have no support from, no information, no knowledge from school or from psychologist. What did I do? I looked in encyclopedias searching for one single entry, homosexuality. What did I find out? That I was a pervert. What did it to me? It only hurt me, no? And for the question, was the word lesbian in circulation, she answered, only as a slur. Even my mother used it as an offensive word. When she finally figured out that this was my orientation, she said the word a few times with hatred, hissing the word at me. These statements describe a high level of persistent hostility towards a family member, sister, daughter, who happens to be a lesbian. The brothers and the mother are so profoundly unable to accept the woman's sexual orientation that they cannot speak about the subject at all. The taboo remains firmly in place for decades. How is it maintained? The quotes all highlight the theme of language, unspeakability, silence. When something remains in the sphere of taboo, there is a gap in representation, both visual and verbal. The word cannot be spoken, it can only be hissed with hatred. The popular discourse, as well as academic literature on the subject, repeatedly uses the term lesbian invisibility to address this problem. In this paper, I propose a different concept and a different frame. I propose to address the question of lesbian identity in pre-1989 Poland, not in terms of visibility and invisibility, but rather in terms of cultural intelligibility or unintelligibility. The former concepts, which have rich history in discussions of pre-emancipatory lesbian experience, presume an already existing identity self-evident to the person in question, that is, the existence of a person who thinks of herself as a lesbian. We then proceed to ask whether or not this lesbian was visible or as such to others, whether others view her, recognize her as the lesbian she knew she was. One important assumption of this frame is that the woman in question wanted to be visible and that visibility was denied to her. Another assumption is that the problem is visibility, whether or not she is seen as what she is. Unintelligibility is a frame that makes no such assumptions. It takes the social construction of identity and the constitutive role of language seriously. To think in those terms is to ask under what conditions same-sex desire between women is culturally legible as constitutive of an identity. So instead of asking if people saw lesbians for who they really were, we try to spot to what extent there existed categories that made a certain type of person socially recognizable to others, but also to herself as lesbians. The problem is shifted from seeing to naming. And Judith Butler uses this concept in the following way in Gender Trouble. The question here will be, to what extent do regulatory practices of gender information and division constitute identity? The internal coherence of the subject, indeed, the self-identical status of the person? To what extent is identity a normative ideal rather than a descriptive feature of experience? And how do the regulatory practices that govern gender and govern culturally... intelligible notions of identity. In other words, the coherence and continuity of the person are not logical or analytical features of personhood, but rather socially instituted and maintained norms of intelligibility. Inasmuch as identity is assured through the stabilizing concepts of sex, gender, and sexuality, the very notion of the person is called into question by the cultural emergence of those incoherent and discontinuous gendered beings who appear to be persons but who fail to conform to the gendered norms or of cultural intelligibility by which persons are defined. To say that lesbians were not cultured, that was the end of the quotation. To say that lesbians were not culturally intelligible is not to claim that there was no woman engaged in same-sex romantic and erotic relationships. Such a claim would be an absurd, of course. It is to suggest that lesbian was not a category of personhood available or, for that matter, desirable. To many non-heteronormative women, they had ways to describing their existence outside the norm, various ways of speaking of what, who they wanted, but the word lesbian did not represent to them the sort of person they felt they were. The interview quotes I read to you at the beginning are filled with pain due to rejection, but unintelligibility has its advantages. The basic one is safety in a profoundly heteronormative society. As long as things go unnamed, the woman is not in danger of stigmatization or social exclusion. Pani Basia, the oldest among Anna Laszuk interviewers, says the following: I cannot say a bad word about my parents. They knew, but they did not comment anything. My parents never asked me personal questions, never exerted any kind of pressure that I get married. They were people of great culture, very understanding, and also they quite simply loved me. They would never meet my various girlfriends, but they were never referred to as anything else but friends. Girls had it much easier than boys did, because intimacy between girls was generally accepted. Nobody was surprised when I came somewhere with a woman, invited her home, held her hand, that we went on trips together. I don't have much time, but I have much material, so I need to skip a lot stuff. And maybe at the end, I want to say that the task before us as researchers of history in Poland, non-heteronormative history, is not just to reconstruct the factual history of this woman's lives, when and how did they become aware of their difference, whether and how they came out, who and how they loved. Our task is first to find the women who were not lesbians and yet loved other women in Polish Pope's Republic. Once found, they need to be engaged in a way that does not disrespect and the specificity of their lived experience. We must construct a language that will adequately address the complexity of experience for which there was no language. Okay, and this is the end, I know. I would like to tell more, but maybe in questions, yes.
To all the points you had not the time to mention here. So now I welcome Margit Hauser from Vienna. I hope everything...
I just need a minute.
Yes,
to
we have here help. Margit Hauser will tell us more about lesbian visibility in women's archives in German-speaking countries. So, I
this
give
was
you
the title.
The word.
My name is Margit Hauser. I'm from Stichwort, Archives of the Women's and Lesbians Movement in Vienna, Austria. Stichwort has existed for 36 years and maintains a feminist library and a movement archive with a focus on Austria. With my contribution, I would like to recall a paradigm shift that took place long before queer debates about constructiveness of gender, asterisks, and changeability of gender identities. It is about making lesbians visible in feminist contexts, which manifests itself at the end of the 1980s in a women's movement in German language countries in the expression Frauenlesben, women lesbians. While lesbians had often for years supported a women's group, an initiative, an association, and had helped to to discuss the problems of heterosexual women without ever discussing their own identity. Now the desire emerged to be perceived and to be addressed as lesbians, not to negotiate their own issues as an extra problem in an extra group at extra meetings, but to negotiate them in the context of the women's movement. Lesbian feminist theory should be part of feminist theory. In many women's groups, a confession, a disclosure of one's own identity and sexuality was demanded. It should no longer play no role in a team's cooperation. It quickly became usual in feminist contexts to add a lesbian in the names of women's groups, magazines, events. This should make it clear that not only heterosexual women were addressed, but also decidedly lesbians, and further, what significance lesbians have in the women's movement. The debate has begun in Germany. It definitely has had a strong influence on the Austrian women's movement. In the following, I will bring examples of archive documents from Germany, Austria, and Switzerland, all from my institution, Stichwort. There are several backgrounds to this development, namely, on the one hand, the lesbian-hetero conflicts and solidarity in a second wave women's movement, and on the other hand, the struggle to make women visible in language beginning in the 1980s. It is to be mentioned that the emergence of the expression women lesbians in the women's movement falls into the time of the dawning debate about racism in the West German movement and the crumbling we. But let us first have a look at the first self-confident lesbian voices. At the beginning of 1975, the HAW Frauengruppe renamed itself Lesbisches Aktionszentrum, and the anonymous writer of the editorial of Lesbenpresse states, "That's why I accept the label lesbian, with which homosexual women have been referred to the subculture, and also because I want to live as a lesbian, and because I know that this is a chance to experience my own identity. We want you to deal with us. To be consciously lesbian in the women's movement means to be radical," wrote the authoress Sappho in May 1976 in Die Lesbe, das Monster, the first text of this kind in Austria, in a very important Auf, a women's magazine. Almost a decade later, on the occasion of the renaming of the Swiss Lesbenfront to Frau ohne Herz, we read in the editorial, "Today, the term lesbian no longer has the absolute foreign word character of the past, yet it is far from self-evident that we exist. According to the principle, it cannot be what must not be, the word lesbian has at most reached the level of crossword puzzle knowledge in general consciousness. Introducing lesbians into the women's movement was also the topic of the workshop Not Again, Oh Yes, Lesbians in the Women's Movement, which our archive held at the 6th Austrian Lesbian Meeting in October 87. If the women's movement were a house, what would the lesbians be? The question already appears very concrete, and in fact, we are approaching the decisive time phase. The first renamings of feminist groups, as well as feminist media from women to women lesbians, can be found in our collections from 1990 onwards. The renaming phase, however, lasted until the mid-90s. The terms were often used side by side. Women was not replaced by women lesbians throughout and at every point. The women's section of the students' representation at the University of Augsburg has already been renamed the Frauenlesbenreferat, Women's Lesbian Section, but the subtitle of the magazine it publishes still bears the title By Women, For Women, About Women. The Women's Lesbian Section of the University of Munich also has no problem naming the newsletter Frauenzeitung München, and also the other way around. What some magazine title promised was not always fulfilled in the inside. The term women lesbians obviously appeared for the first time in a political action in Innsbruck, the Women's Day, March 91, which was focused against the Gulf War, and triggered discussions in the Women's Center and Zyklotron, the magazine of the Women's Center Innsbruck. Who I love is my private affair, and I don't want to be put a priori into boxes, versus let's oppose symbolic non-representation with a symbolic existence. Ways of writing were both women lesbians with a slash, as well as women lesbians written together, whereby lesbians with capital letters stood out as a separate term. And also illustrated in different symbol variants, as you see here on the right side down. Sometimes lesbians were also placed in front, as in the subtitle of the militant autonomous magazine Amazora. In this magazine, there is certainly a consistent use of women lesbians, and what comes in from the outside and does not fit in the concept is made to fit in, as happened with the description of the feminist squatting in Graz. You see the original up and down is the handwritten version they made in the Amazora. One of the freest ways of dealing with a new term was the Women's Communication Center in Vienna. Their magazine Frauennachrichten then appeared as Frauen-Lesben-Nachrichten or Lesben-Frauen-Nachrichten, always depending on the final editor. Of course, the question quickly arose, are women automatically heterosexual women so that it is necessary to add lesbians? Aren't lesbians also women? Central criticism comes from an anonymous position paper on the concept of women and lesbians, which was published in 1989 in May issue of the Bremer magazine Etze. According to my information, it comes from Münster, women or lesbians, and comes from the context of the nationwide Women Against Gene and Reproduction Technologies meeting, and is dated May 1989. The term women and lesbians is directed against our lesbian identity, they said. Among other things, they reject the term because it excludes lesbians from being women and strengthens the prevailing norm. Every woman can be a lesbian. It was printed without comment by the editors of the magazine Etze. In the following issue, a reader's letter of a single woman appeared, nothing else. Unlike this text, others in the movement approached the contradictions of the term with humor. A number of variations depict the discussion of the term. The Berlin magazine Infam called itself in a subtitle Frauen-Hetera-Zeitung, women's hetera newspaper. These are women's lesbians hetero by a auto, that is this women's and blah editorial stuff, they call themselves in the editorial of issue 1 in 89. And the editorial of the magazine Furien in summer 92 draws our attention to the feminist department for women and other lesbians. The debate about lesbian visibility has also had a strong impact on women's archives and libraries. I would like to tell of the debate in a network of German-speaking women's archives and pick out one archive as an example. The debate about making lesbians visible in the holdings of our archives and libraries began at the 15th meeting in Berlin in spring 1991. The debate was initiated by Lesbenarchiv Spinnboden Berlin. In their welcoming address, they formulated, as hosts, we have come up with a lesbian provocation paper to point out that lesbians work in most women's archives and libraries, but that this has not been an issue at any meeting so far. As a lesbian archive, we found it time to bring the language to us lesbians. They presented the whole range of questions we just have heard of in a scenic performance. In the minutes of this meeting, the term Lesbenfrauen was used for the first time, both in the name and in the name of the meeting and in the text. In the following meeting in Vienna in October 91, the first working group Lesbians in Ring Binders took place, and this working group was held until spring 94, which is 7 or 8 times. In the beginning, only 6 of more than 20 participating archives listed lesbians as a separate term in their catalogues. It was discussed how lesbian collections, especially in the libraries, could be made visible without being placed in a corner again. Some introduced a marking system with dots on the spine to express lesbian issues included. One consequence of the discussion was that the institutions were generally more concerned with lesbian issues. For example, in 1992, the Frauen-Lesben-Bibliothek Zürich published a lesbian book list for the first time. It took some years before the new term appeared regularly in the self-description of the network. In 1994, the Dachverband IDA was founded out of the Archive Treffen, and it was decided that lesbians should be mentioned first in the name of the roof organization, umbrella organization. My own institution was renamed in 1990 from Archive of the New Women's Movement to Stichwort Archive of the Women's and Lesbians Movement. The proposal had been brought in by a lesbian activist in a team and was met with approval quite quickly. As usual, a coming out session in a team was part of the process. I must add that at that time in Austrian criminal law, 2 paragraphs were still valid that prohibited advertising for same-sex fornication and fornication with animals. It was the same paragraph. Threatened penalty was a prison sentence up to 6 months, as well as the founding of associations to the favoring of same-sex fornication. So we were sort of courageous then. The name change was accompanied by a slight change in content. We endeavored to do justice to the new name in our holdings and supplemented our library with lesbian theory and literature. In our archives, we focused more on lesbian activism in Austria and internationally. Lesbians were encouraged to apply when we offered a job. Furthermore, we changed the indexing practice in a way that lesbian texts may not only be tagged with lesbian notations, so that users searching for general topics also get lesbian books in their hands. In this way, lesbian literature was to be removed from the lesbian corner. After about 25 years of this practice, I can say this works. That's a good final sentence, so thank you for your attention.
So thank you very much. You were just in time. We have 1 minute left for the next speaker or for the discussion. Now Maria Bühner presents us Lesbian Traces in the Records of the East German State Security Service. So, very welcome. Maybe you need just 1 second.
Hello, everybody. I'm really happy to see such a packed room. Today, I present findings of a case study on the relationship between the East German intelligence and secret police called Ministry for State Security, commonly shortened as Stasi, and the lesbian rights activism that emerged in the 1980s. The case study is part of my PhD research on lesbian subjectification in the German Democratic Republic. My theoretical approach is informed by subject theory, gender history, and the history of emotions, as well as body history. I argue that there is no fixed lesbian subject. Rather, it gets constructed by different actors in different fields, which nevertheless relate to each other. To look into these different fields, I use a wide variety of sources. The Stasi Records Archives are a federal agency that is funded by the German government, and it is the most well-funded archive I've ever went to. Their work is to host the archives to archive the records and investigate them. The following quote outlines some of the complex entanglements between the lesbian rights activism and the Stasi, which I will outline today. The sphere of influence of the state did not even stop at the corner of the bed, if it was in its alleged interest. The Stasi made use of the fact that lesbians and gays who were not living openly and who would back then could be blackmailed. In that sense, it was already a political issue for female citizens of the GDR not to follow the predestinated ways of life and not to hide this fact. And it was political to take a stand in private against the interventions of the state. These are reflections by Bärbel Klaessner, who co-founded in the mid-1980s a lesbian group in Jena, which later published the first and only lesbian samizdat, Frau Anders, Miss Different. My research explores the potentials and limits of the records of the Stasi for writing a her story of lesbians in the GDR. The very high number of files prove that the Stasi had a vivid interest in the lesbian and homosexual activist groups that were founded in the 1980s. These groups were all illegal since the GDR knew no freedom of association. The Stasi considered them a security threat, mainly due to their international contacts, their contacts to other oppositional groups within the milieu of the Protestant Church, and the fact that they challenged prevailing ideas of gender and sexuality. Intense observation brought the Stasi to two conclusions in the mid-1980s. Firstly, the state had to improve the living conditions of its homosexual citizens to prevent a further politicization. There were also other developments that had made homosexuality a political issue in the second half of the 1980s. New academic understandings of homosexuality as an equal form of sexuality, and the emergence of AIDS, of course. Sensing a loss of control, the regime developed official policies on homosexuality in an attempt to reassert its power. Different public agencies collaborated so that the welfare dictatorship could solve the problems of the homosexuals. The second conclusion was that the Stasi needs to systematically observe and try to destabilize the existing groups. Therefore, they collected as much information as possible on the groups and their active members, but also developed strategies to destroy or at least destabilize the groups. This was only possible due to the use of lesbian and bisexual informants. The Stasi called them mostly inoffizielle Mitarbeiter, IM, which can be translated as unofficial colleagues. I'm especially interested in the role of these informants because they break the seemingly clear dichotomy between victims and penetrators. I want to highlight some source-related challenges. the access to the files is restricted. So you can't just walk in there like you can do with all the lovely LGBTIQ archives, but you actually have to go through a whole process in which you are applying to be able to have the access to the files. The selection of the files is done by the archivist based on the information provided by the researcher. The strict rules about anonymization result in the blacking out of any real names. Additionally, the files are usually incomplete to protect personal information or because certain pages are not considered to be relevant by the archivist. This is a huge problem since it makes the inner logic of the files invisible and limits the ways in which I can contextualize the given information. So I've actually never seen a whole file. The content of the files themselves has to be treated with care. Since there was a high pressure to prove efficiency and very personal reasons for the informants and officers to lie. By reading the files, it becomes apparent that gaps of all different kinds are often not marked. Instead, they wanted to seem efficient. There are also mistakes in the reports. Besides, given that in a lot of files, sensitive information obtained in illegal ways is provided, there are certain ethical questions in using them. It has to be considered whether the research might reproduce, at least to a certain extent, the often voyeuristic and criminalizing, sometimes pathologizing gauge which is present throughout the material. This might especially be the case when quoting certain, I would call them, sensitive passages, for example, concerning sexual activities. In general, the material is so strongly biased that mainly it gives us insights in the logics, evaluations, and the actions of these institutions. We don't learn much about lesbian self-understandings when studying these files. With the help of the files, it is possible to reconstruct what a lesbian was in the understanding of the Stasi. The language in the records is very bureaucratic, seemingly objective, and soaked in political phrases and terminologies. Additionally, there is a very strong othering present. That might have something to do with the fact that the big majority of the officers was male and that their living realities had very little in common with those of the activists. The lesbians appear to be dangerous, mysterious, or sometimes simply hysterical women out of control. Or they also had trouble to spell the word right, by the way. Based on the records, it is possible to study how the foundation of more and more activist groups in the 1980s built up the pressure to act up on their demands. This is a chapter of the history of East Germany, which still needs to be researched in depth, since we are only beginning to understand the complex entanglements between a change in the official politics concerning homosexuality and the intense observation of lesbian homosexual activists by the Stasi. The informants are the key figures for understanding this development. The violence of lesbian activists was widespread and took place in every single one of the lesbian and homosexual activist groups. The Stasi specifically targeted lesbians who were actively participating in these groups, but there are also other cases known. For the Stasi, the groups were perceived as to pose a security risk. The Stasi feared, as one report from February 1986 stated, a political abuse of homosexuals by the usurpation by hostile forces, meaning the West, and consequently understood them as part of the opposition movement. To deal with the growing homosexual movement, the Stasi sought to, and I quote, destroy organizational structures and make certain involved persons insecure, which is the nice expression for the so-called Zersetzung. The literal translation is corroding or decomposition. Especially with groups and individuals which were rated as hostile negative. They did this. It was mainly the work of the informants that provided the necessary information, and they even carried out some of the missions. To give you a few examples, Ursula Silge, who founded a secular homosexual rights group, Sonntagsclub, in East Berlin, was spied upon by a dozen informants. A head of the homosexual working group in Karl-Marx-Stadt was systematically spied on by a confidential informant who chose the alias Anne Frank. The informant even told the Stasi what was going on in bed between them. The documentary filmmaker Barbara Wallbraun, who has done a lot of research on the informants, suggests to call those who did such things I Am Julias. The male counterpart, the so-called I Am Romeos, have already been known in research. So this is about using sex to carry out missions for the Stasi or getting certain informations. The informant, Anne Frank, also stopped a woman in Zwickau from founding a homosexual working group by systematically pushing her insecurities. Another example of an intervention by the Stasi is the police violence they coordinated in 1985 to stop the East Berlin-based group Lesben in der Kirche, Lesbians in the Church, the first lesbian group that was ever founded in the GDR, from going to Ravensbrück and commemorating the lesbian victims of the Nazi period. That's something, I look at this in another bits and parts of my research. Very interesting story, but also disturbing. What were the reasons to do something like this? For the informants. Some were blackmailed into spying for the Stasi. Their homosexuality made them especially vulnerable for this. Others did it for political reasons or personal advantages. There were also financial stimuli. They were usually paid when they carried out their missions successfully. Missions included actions like gathering private information on people or participating in meetings and acting in a certain way to cause, for example, conflicts within the groups, etc. For some, it was also the fascination of participating in something secret and mysterious. Others simply seemed to enjoy to talk freely. When I read what I read in some of the protocols reminded me of what Foucault calls the will to knowledge and describes as the pleasure of confession. The officers who recruited the informants were psychologically skilled. And even if the way they wrote about informants showed that they were opposed to homosexuality, they did not show this during their regular meetings with them. Especially for younger informants, the meetings with the officers sometimes were the first place where they could openly speak about their homosexuality and their contradicting feelings about it. Carrying out missions could also create the feeling to be important. This is not meant to be an excuse for denunciation, but it is important to look into the complexity of the relationships between informants and officers. Some of the informants also tried to use this as an opportunity to explain the difficult living conditions for homosexuals and try to assure that homosexuals were brave citizens, not public enemies. Theresa Tammer comes to the same conclusion for the informants who were active in the gay scene. The efforts of the Stasi had paradox effects. They pushed informants to take active roles in the movement in order to secure their position. How this maybe have strengthened the groups has yet to be studied. Nevertheless, it is for sure that the criminalization of the homosexual and lesbian activism brought the politicization of homosexuality forward and made it a political question which had to be acted upon. The seemingly endless records of the Stasi tempt one to focus a lot of time and energy on them. But the gain of knowledge is limited, and we also have to ask ourselves carefully, which perspectives and interpretations do we want to bring forward? his/her/his story of sexualities should, whenever it is possible, include ego documents and other documents by those who lived these lives and fought those fights. This is why I would recommend to go to the Grauzone Archive, the Archive of the Independence Women's Movement of the GDR, the Spinnenboden Lesbian Archive, the Archive of the Schwules Museum Berlin, and to visit the Digital German Women's Archive, because these are very important places to learn more about lesbian and feminist self-understandings. Thank you for your attention.
So this was really a speech just in time, exact with the second and minute. So now, last but not least, Sabine Balke Estremadiora will speak on the Digital Women's Archive, DDF. And maybe in the minute,
how to.
Yep. Okay, so now we can.
Okay.
Does it work? Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so.
Okay.
The place is yours.
Thank you that I can speak here. It's an honor for me to have this audience. Hello. My name is Sabine Balke Estremadiro, and I am the director of the Digital Archive from the Women's Movement in Germany. Before that, I was the manager of the META project, and I am also in the steering committee of the IDA network, who calls Margit, and we are both in the steering committee. And at least I'm also working with Katja, my colleague, in the Lesbian Archive Spinnenboden in Berlin. I will deal my lecture answer in these three questions. Who is the IDA network? What is META? And what is the Digital German Women's Archive? I call it DDF. It's better because it's so long. So the first, IDA is a network, is the umbrella organization of 40 German language lesbians and women's libraries, archives and documentation centers in Germany, Austria, Luxembourg, Italy and Switzerland. These institutions have been cooperating since 1983. They complement one another with regard to collections and emphasis of documentations. Since 1994, they have been organized as IDA network. As umbrella organization, IDA is responsible for international public relations and the support of lesbian and women's libraries, archives and documentation center in political and financial matters. This support is necessary because what all IDA institutions have in common are the limited financial resources and a lot of work done on volunteer basis. The META online catalog is designed for researchers, students, teachers, and anyone else interested in information on the history of lesbian and women's movement. META provides a quick access to relevant resources on the history of women's movement. META goes online at 2015. Now the catalog is integrated in the Digital Women's Archive. The development of META is supported by the German Ministry of Family Affairs, Senior Citizens, Women's and Youth. What is the Digital German Women's Archive? The DDF, that we call it DDF, enable the preservation, publication, and research of old and new women's movements, and promote their further development in the digital age. Documents, magazines, books, buttons, films, all kinds of records, about 30 archives, it's only the German archives who are in the DDF, have collected and digitized original documents on women's lesbian history. The new platform gives them the opportunity to make the material more accessible online. Here you can see one of the first lesbian novels in Germany, The Scorpion, written by Anna Elisabeth Weihrauch. This novel is one of Weihrauch's most well-known novels which deal with lesbian life and love. In 1977, without the permission from the publisher, lesbians who find this book had already reproduced this novel. They wish to make it accessible to our lesbian community because it is an important document of our not very well documented history, they said. Anna Elisabeth Weihrauch was a German author. Weihrauch was an important figure of lesbians for lesbians in Germany in the early 90s, as well for lesbians in the 70s and 80s. Here you can see the page about her history in the Digital Women's Archive. One of the most sobering discoveries for feminists in the 70s was the discovery of the first woman movement dating back to the mid-19th century. Sometimes they simply knew something they simply knew nothing about. That knowledge was gotten lost. People might have heard of the suffragettes in England who were much more militant than German, but nobody knew about Anita Augsburg or Helene Lange or anything at all about the very active bourgeois woman movement in Germany. At the left hand, you can see Anita Augsburg and her feminist associates Verein für Frauenstimmrecht, Suffragettes Association. The next is Marie Stritt, then Lili von Giersig, Mina Kauer is also a very famous suffragette in the first movement, and the French Sophie Gottsticker. Photographed at the Elvira Studio in Munich in 1896. Anita Augsburg was a lesbian activist of the radical feminist movement in Germany. Back to Anna Elisabeth. Weihrauch was also an actor. She works for the German State Theater in Berlin from 1992 to 1919, where she acted until she found her love for writing. This is the review album from Anna Elisabeth that digitized for the DDF from the lesbian archive Spinnboden. I don't know if you can see it good. Here you can see the open review album with all the articles of her plays. You can select the page to read the article in this in our archive. And this is a lesbian journal from 1988. At that time, you can buy this journal at the kiosk in Berlin. You can see also the different pages of the magazine in the DDF. And now we take a look at the DDF and the page of another lesbian journal from the 20s. Liebende Frauen, loving women. And so it looks like when you go in the digital archive. The general digital women archives which emerged from a merger of institutions of the IDA umbrella organization also organized a feminist conference when we go online with the digital archive. In Germany, we have the adage, tu Gutes und sprich darüber. You do a good work and you have to speak about it. So we organized the feminist summer camp when we got online with the digital archive last year. We have about 60 different events and panels and one at one day about the feminist movement in Germany and in Europe. Without women, there is no democracy. This is the title from our next feminist conference in Leipzig tomorrow. Leipzig is not so far from Berlin, about 2 hours by train, if you want to come. In Leipzig demonstrate several women for a free country in 1989 before the wall is open and the 9th November from 1989. We are celebrate this year 30 years after the wall is open and we want to show at the conference how women was involved in this movement and how are the women who demonstrate in the streets of Leipzig at this time. This is our address in the internet, and we have also a newsletter, and we are at Facebook and Twitter. And at least I want to show you this. At least here is the citation from Luise Otto Peters from 1848. Luise Otto Peters was called the mother of the feminist movement in Germany. The history of all times teach that those who have been forgotten, who forgot to think about themselves. Thank you.
So thank you very much. Now I want to ask all the speakers to come here. And now there's the possibility to ask questions, to debate. We have here in the room a microphone. And who wants to ask something? Yes, yes.
My name is Ole Egan, and I'm from Barkley, Madeleine, I just want to ask you, you said that lesbian wasn't a word that people used to describe themselves, but was there another word that people used, or was there some way that people made themselves visible to each other?
It's working. So I think that word lesbian was... it wasn't an unknown word, but it was a slur rather than a word to describe oneself. And I think that there wasn't anything else. Like it was unspoken, but it's the women I interviewed. After the interview, sometimes they agree that we can call them lesbians. Like, yes, okay, I am a lesbian because there is no other better word. But it's not like the first choice or, you know.
So, anyone else? Yes, I see here.
I had a question for Maria, I think. That was an amazing presentation and amazing work you did. I was really curious about the fact you said how difficult it was to get in there, to those archives, and to research them. Do you anticipate that will get easier in the future? And is it worthwhile for other researchers to go into those archives?
Well, thank you for the compliment. For me, as a researcher, as a PhD student of a university, it wasn't difficult. I just asked my supervisor, and because of this, it was accessible for me. And I mean, I got all the copies for free. I'm like flooding and Stasi files in my office. I think if you are not a researcher from a university or from it is more difficult, and also maybe you have to pay for it. I don't think it will get easier because there's like a really special law concerning all these records which restrict the access to them.
I just wanted to say these were all phenomenal panelists. Thank you for your research and your work. My question was for Sabina. When did the Women's Digital Archive start, and how did they get funding?
We started last year in September. Yes.
Yes. In 2016.
I get online. We get online in last year, but we started in 2016. Thank you. It's my colleague in the umbrella organization, Margit. It's my best colleague. We started in 2016, and we get the funding from the government about this 4 million a year before we get this, and we negotiated, and now we are also in the negotiating for the next period. And we are very pleased to say we have the funding after 2020, and I think we have a lot of work to do in the next 10 years.
So, give me a sign if you want to question something, and I find it would be very polite to maybe mention your name and even your institution when you are from an archive, museum, and so, just to make networking afterwards.
Hi, I'm Katie Sutton from the Australian National University. Thank you for those really great papers. They're all really fascinating. I just had another practical question for Sabina about the digital Frauenarchiv. Is the idea that the entire collections at each of these IDA organisations will be digitalised in the course of this project? And is there also potential that some of the materials housed, say, in the state libraries, the federal libraries, that might be relevant to the project will also be included in that?
At the first step, we only digitize the stuff from the umbrella organization, from IDA. And there is a lot of work to do in this. But we are in discussion to open to another to digitize, because we know there is so much more stuff in other archives about the women movements that we know we have to open. But what I not mention is that we have give money for these digitized projects for the archives. Like Stichwort, we couldn't give the money because he is in Austria, but the other archives in Germany get the funding for digitize, and this is also for employed people in the archives. And so it's only for 1 year, but it is money. And this is why we said that at the first week the money is for this archives, for the umbrella organization archives, but then we have to open the archive, and I hope we get more money to digitize this.
So over there is another question.
It was another question. No, you couldn't digitize all the things, because you have to to see that it is you can't do all the things in the digitized archives in the internet, but you can, from your organization, from your archive, said this is the most for us the best we can do it for the internet. And so the Lesbian Archive digitized the Lesbian magazine from the 20s and this book from Anna Elisabeth Weihrauch.
Hi, I'm Judith Takács from Budapest, from the Center for Social Sciences of the Hungarian Academy of Sciences, and I really enjoyed these presentations, so thank you very much. And I have a question to Maria. I wanted to congratulate to your research. This is great. And I also wanted to ask whether you do any kind of comparative research with other post-socialist countries where they also had perhaps not as effective mechanism as this TASI introduced, but I guess comparable ones. I'm doing similar research in Hungary, and what you have mentioned about, you know, these techniques the TASI applied, these sound very familiar in the Hungarian context. So I'm asking whether this is part of your research to try to, you know, bridge your findings with some other comparable, with other countries in comparable situations. Thank you.
The short answer is yes, I do, because I think these her stories, his stories we are looking at are transnational ones, and we need to contextualize them in a broader context than a regional one or a national one. So I'm looking into this too, but I'm relying in this case on the work of researchers like you, because I don't speak these languages. But yes, I think this is really interesting and really necessary, but also only possible if your research is well funded, which is probably a reason why a lot of the state-of-the-art we have is more focused on the regional and the national level, because you need more time, and time means money, to put it in transnational perspectives. But I will try my very best to do so with the findings of this case study.
Hi, thank you all. I'm E.G. Creighton, and I'm an artist working out of San Francisco, California. This is kind of to any of you, in some way you're all addressing identity categories and the names used for them, both lesbian and women, and I'm wondering how genderqueer and trans identities are, or if they are, affecting the work that you do and the research that you do, and how you, as a, both individually and as groups, work.
I try my very best to do so, but it is very limited, like in terms of if we look at the self-understandings of the actors of the time. But I'm also looking in the trans part of this her story I'm working with, but this is mainly limited to files from I'm always having trouble spelling this word right. From the psychiatry, like the Charité Berlin, the psychiatric ward. So this is like a really pathologizing view. But I try to work with it and make it possible. Yeah. But I think these stories are very under-documented.
In the whole cruise of research, I think those categories are we do have interviews with trans people also, there is something that I'm just starting to do research on this. There is a theory that in Polish Pop's Republic in 70s or 90s, there was a huge group of women who transited to men, and it was the bigger amount than in other countries. So this is something very interesting that I need to find out, because maybe this is also a question, the answer to the question about the disappearance of lesbian women in Poland.
And for the archive, for the DDF, we have from the government said it was a women's archive, and we have the staff who are in the archives to digitize. And when the staff is there from the trans or inter people, we can do it, but in the moment we don't have the staff and don't digitize it. It's for us. I only want to say that when we get the summer camp last year and I say we are a lesbians and a women's movement, the government come and say, "Ah, Frau Balke, why do you say every day lesbian and women's movement? Take it all the women's movement. It's doch, it's right." And I say, no, we have a lesbian and women's umbrella organization, and this is what we call. And so we have to deal also with the government in this point.
So, hi, thank you for your presentations. My question goes to Maria and Magdalena. I'm Clara Wuppen for Lola for Democracy in Mecklenburg-Western Pomerania. So my question would be, how do the contemporary witnesses that you interview, how do they react to your research? Are they, do they feel like a very late appreciation, or does it also crack open old wounds? I can imagine mostly with the Stasi, like when they know that you also, yeah, in your two different presentations, like, yeah, how do they react?
So firstly, it is very hard to find women who like to talk about their experiences from that time. And secondly, when finally we find them, and after first thing is I think gender thing, that women don't want to speak about themselves because they think they don't have anything interesting to say. Then after 3 hours of interview, finally they find out, oh yes, there was an interesting story. And of course, I think that they are glad after the interview that it happened.
Well, oral history interviews are not at the focus of what the material I'm working with. I've done some, but it was more for me to get a better feeling for the understandings and the experiences of these people. I mean, these people, this is such a distance language. I was really curious, but I was really scared at the same time. I decided not, or just very carefully use the interviews, because they are really difficult to deal with, and I wanted to tell a big story, and I couldn't have done this only based on the interviews. I mean, not given the fact that it is a PhD, but the interviews I had were really moving. I mean, they really moved me, and they inspired me, and for me it was really, really awesome to meet all the lesbians. But I carefully thought about what questions I wanted to ask them, because I didn't want anybody to push. I didn't want to push anybody to talk about something that might have been traumatic for them or whatever. So I wanted them to choose what they want to share with me, instead of just like, yeah, thinking about my own research agenda.
So here's one.
Thank you. Thank you for amazing presentations. My name is Frederick from the University of Toronto. I was wondering, Magdalena, what the earliest kind of archival material you could find in Poland? It's kind of a self-help question. I'm doing a project on World War II Warsaw, and I haven't been able to find a lot in terms of anything, really. So wondering if you have any experience there. Thank you.
So My research starts in 70s, so your question is about the earlier period, but of course there are materials about 19th century or the first half of 20th century. But do you mean books or literature, or what kind of archival materials? So for sure, you can go to National Library or the big archives, and you can. But there are researchers who know better this subject, like also on this auditorium. So maybe I can introduce you, because my research is on other period of time. I'm sorry.
So I'm now collecting the last two, three questions, because then we have to finish. So here's one.
Hi, I'm Sapir, and I'm from the Activism Archive in Israel, which we're trying to build without the support from the government. We don't want to anyway, so it's okay. I want to ask, from collecting the materials, did you do, what kind of actions did you do? Otherwise of call for action, or you know, trying to publish on Facebook and in other networks of activists and queer activists. Like, did you do something specifically to find the materials? Because I found it very hard to reach out for the people, which also thinks not only for interviews, they think that the materials that they have are not important enough, so they don't even think about bringing them to anyone to examine them. So maybe what kind of activities did you do to find the materials and reach out to people? Thank you.
We have all the materials in our archives in the Umbrella Organization, and how the archives are did they work? It's so different. Sometimes the lesbian archives in Berlin, Spinborn, was well known, and so they people come to us and say, "I have here my material. I want to give you them." But also when we get this magazine from this journal from the 20s, we have to go to an auction, and to buy this magazine. I go there and buy the magazine for us, for the Lesbian Archive. And so it's so different how the material is coming to us. I think it was good to be in Facebook or Twitter and say, we are here, we have this material, and you have to do to speak in your community that you are collecting all this stuff. And so, but it takes years. It takes a lot of years. I don't know when you are started collecting in your town, but it takes years. And the Lesbian Archive is now about more than 40 years old.
I can support this, because we get material of, we have the documentation of more than 900 autonomous feminist groups in Austria, and we get the material constantly from those groups, or when a woman wants to clean her apartment and then she brings some bags full of material, and it comes through different ways to our archive, for example, It is constantly growing. It is never ended. We cannot say this is the folder about this group, because all of a sudden a car comes by and they open the door and bring all what fits into the car into our archive, and then we have meters of material to this group, and so it happens all the time.
So here's the next question.
Yeah, hello. My name is Sarah Bornost from the Berlin Wall Foundation. I have one question to Maria. And you pointed out the strategies the Stasi used against these groups. And some of them sounds quite similar to strategies the Stasi used to other or to influence other groups. So can you point out some specific, or are there any specific strategies specifically used for homosexual groups?
I ask myself the same questions. I would say no. I would say they were doing what they were doing with those people who they perceived as enemy to the socialist order.
So now the last question, I'm sorry.
Thank you to the panel and to everyone. I enjoyed it all. My name is Carol from the Cork LGBT Archive. My question is to Maria. I'm not suggesting they should have felt a certain way or anything, and I take on board that you said that you didn't press your subjects, you just let them speak as they chose to speak. But the people who informed, the gay and lesbian act informants, if that's okay to call them that, did any... I don't want to suggest people should say anything particularly, so my question is a bit, I suppose, I'm a little bit reserved in my question, but did anyone you interviewed express remorse, regret, or look back and think, would they have done what they did? Did they have any sense of observing their actions differently now that the times had moved on or history had changed, you know? Or that's just my question, really. And thank you for all the work. It was fascinating, you know?
Well, maybe I should specify that I haven't done any interviews with informants. All the findings I presented today are based on the records. But from other areas, for example, like from those who, like from some gay informants, we know that they are like that there is a variety of feelings, and that there are people who regret this, but others still stand with what I've done. It's a quite wide field of emotional reactions, I would say.
So I want to end this panel. We have time for discussions, maybe in the coffee breaks and so on. I have to do two announcements. The first one is water will be available with lunch on the terrace on the roof here of the building. We want to ask you to bring water with you tomorrow, and we try to organize and to arrange a water station where you can fill up your own bottles. So this I want to say. And the second and last thing I want to ask you, please give a warm applause to all our speakers for their wonderful speeches.